His name may not be as widely recognized as some of the big sluggers or flamethrowers of his era, but Bobby Shantz's impact on the game is undeniable. From his humble beginnings in Pottstown, Pennsylvania, to the bright lights of Shibe Park and Yankee Stadium, Shantz's story is one of perseverance, talent, and a whole lot of heart. At 98 years old, Bobby Shantz is the second oldest living former Major League Baseball player. He was born in 1925, lived through the Great Depression, almost died at the age of six from a serious illness. And believe me when I tell you this, though he loved the game of baseball with all his heart, there was almost zero chance that he would play beyond high school. That illness that he had when he was a kid likely stunted his growth, and at 17 years old, he stood just 4'9" tall and weighed 110 pounds. Miraculously, just a few years later, after serving his country dutifully during World War II, Shantz had grown to 5'6.5". Now, look, his pitching ability was never in question. I mean, Bobby Shantz could throw. He had a devastating curveball. But now, at 5'6.5", he was just tall enough to catch the eye of one generous scout for the Philadelphia Athletics, who gave the unlikely prospect a chance. With the door to a major league career cracked open, Shantz did not disappoint. He overachieved at every single level, finishing his 16-year career a three-time All-Star, 1952 AL MVP, an eight-time Gold Glove winner, including the very first Gold Glove ever given to a pitcher in 1957, was a World Series champion, and a member of the Philadelphia Baseball Wall of Fame. Grab your peanuts and Cracker Jack, because this is the Bobby Shantz story, a tale of triumph, adversity, and the enduring spirit of America's pastime. 98-year-old Bobby Shantz is my guest on this month's episode of the Lost Ballparks podcast.
This is Harry Carey with Jack Buck and Jerry Gross from the beautiful new Bush Memorial Stadium. And boy, I tell you, this is some sight.
The crowd still is coming in. The bleacher area in center field almost filled. And the indication is that it's going to be a fine Friday night crowd here at the Polo Grounds.
We're underway in the first of a twi-night doubleheader at Tiger Stadium.
Greetings, baseball fans. This is Mel Allen greeting you from Yankee Stadium in New York City.
The F&M Schaefer Brewing Company, very happy to be pouring it to you from Ebbets Field tonight. And there should be a humdinger.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Al Helfer with Art Gleason bringing you Mutual's Game of the Day from sunny Shibe Park in the city of Philadelphia.
Just the start of things. Go pull up a comfortable chair. If you want to take your shoes off, go ahead. Wiggle your toes, and we hope you'll have a cold Schaefer or two throughout the evening.
Bobby Shantz, how are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm doing great. Doing great.
Are you going to call me if you want to talk about ballparks?
Yeah.
Well, you want to know how many home runs I threw?
Who were some of your favorite ball players as a kid? Who did you like growing up?
Ted Williams, Joe DiMaggio. And I end up trying to get him out.
Yeah, not only did you try to get Joe DiMaggio out, but then after, I think it was after the 1951 season, there were a team of a group of Major League All-Stars that went over to play a series of games in Japan, and Joe was on your team.
Yeah, I went over on that trip.
What was Joe like to play with?
Yeah, nice. He never said too much. He was pretty quiet. Very nice person, though. Nice guy.
He probably appreciated, though, that you were on his team in Japan because you had your way with the Yankees.
Yeah, I don't know if he appreciated it or not, but he probably didn't even know I was over there. Every once in a while, I see him later, and he didn't like to sign autographs. If somebody was selling his autograph or something, I don't know what the hell he was talking about, but he told me he didn't like to sign autographs anymore because too many people were selling. He signed my autograph. He was really nice to me.
You were born in Pottstown, Pennsylvania, and you and your brother used to have used to play catch in the backyard. Did your brother help you with your famous curveball?
Yeah, he helped with my control. He was a very good catcher. He caught for 4 years in the big leagues, almost 5 years in the big leagues, too. He was a pretty good catcher.
As a kid, your daily routine would include going to school, playing baseball, and then listening to radio adventure programs. Do you remember listening to Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy?
Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy. Yeah, I remember that.
Today, Jack Armstrong starts on a brand new radio adventure, one of the most exciting and dangerous he's ever had.
Did he advertise Wheaties? Was he the guy that had Wheaties?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, I did remember that.
We hope that you'll all get a lot of thrills and real pleasure out of Jack Armstrong's newest adventure and that you'll make the acquaintance of those extra good Wheaties flakes right away.
Yeah, that was nice. I enjoyed that.
Speaking of Wheaties, you and your brother probably ate your share because in the late 20s and early 30s, money was tough to come by, so Wheaties actually helped your family get all the baseball equipment that you wanted, balls, bats, gloves. How did you guys do that?
We sent box tops, Wheaties box tops, to get balls and bats and stuff.
You would redeem the cereal box tops?
Yeah, that's how we got our paraphernalia.
Yeah, you probably would have to get hundreds.
Yeah, we had to eat a lot of Wheaties.
So, would you do this for me? Would you eat a breakfast of champions the next 4 mornings in a row? Then ask yourself, if you've ever found any other breakfast dish that gives you as much real pleasure and satisfaction as this combination of Wheaties, milk, and fruit.
They should have had you do a Wheaties commercial.
Yeah, I've never been nice, but they never did look for me. I know that.
They need to put you on the box now.
Yeah, that would be nice.
Your high school coach, is it true that he told you to forget about being a pitcher?
No, he didn't tell me to forget about being a pitcher, but he thought I was too small to pitch. That's why they put me in the outfield.
Was there like part of you that thought, okay, I'm in the outfield now, but I know I was meant to pitch? Did you feel like that?
I really don't know if I was meant to pitch. I was just lucky to be anywhere. If they put me anywhere, I was happy to be there. But I didn't really feel about pitching until when I used to throw to my brother. He used to work with me with my curveball. I had a pretty good curveball. I always did have a pretty good curveball. I couldn't throw that hard, but I didn't know if I was ever going to be a pitcher. But as it ended up, I ended up being a pretty good pitcher, I guess.
In high school, of course, you were on the baseball team, but you also were a diver.
Yeah, I was. I used to dive a little bit. I used to like to swim. We used to go up to Sunnybrook, up near Pottstown. Me and my brother, we used to go up there all the time.
You and Bill?
Yeah.
After high school in 1944, you had such a good season with your Sandlot team, the Holmesburg Ramblers, that you were named to the Connie Mack All-Star team. The irony that one day you would actually be managed by Connie Mack.
Yeah, that was pretty good, I guess, yeah.
And to me, the incredible thing about you being managed by Connie Mack is just how far his career went back in baseball, all the way to the 1880s.
Born during the Civil War, Connie Mack began playing baseball when Army forts still guarded the western frontier. By 1886, when folks still rode in buggies and horse cars, he was a professional ball player, catcher for the Washington Senators.
It's just amazing when you think about how years before you played for Connie Mack that you were on the Connie Mack All-Star team. So then after high school, you served in World War II. Thank you for your service, by the way. You served in the Philippines, right?
Yeah, thank you.
You were eventually signed by the Philadelphia Athletics, and you made your major league debut on May 6th, 1949 at Detroit's Briggs Stadium, which would be later named Tiger Stadium.
Briggs Stadium, like Wrigley Field in Chicago, is one of the finest ballparks in the country. It's packed with loyal fans.
Man, what do you remember about that experience, Bobby?
Nobody's asked me about that in 50 years. I remember relieving, I think I relieved Carl Scheib.
That's right, yeah.
Was it Carl Scheib?
It was Carl Scheib, yeah.
Yeah, and I came in pretty early in the game, and I pitched most of that game. In fact, might have went into the extra innings. I'm not even sure, but I ended up winning that game, I think. I'm not even sure of that anymore. I think that was my first win in the big leagues in Detroit.
And tell me about coming out, I would assume because you came in relief out of the bullpen, and walking out in front of a major league crowd in that stadium. What was that moment like?
I was scared to death. I was shaking. I was hoping the hell I could get the ball over the plate, that's all. It turned out pretty good. I don't think I walked too many guys. I don't know if I struck out too many, but I ended up winning the game. I owe that.
Was there always a special place in your heart for Briggs Stadium where it all started?
I always did like to pitch against Detroit, but they had a pretty good hitting ball club with Al Kaline and Harvey Keene. And guys, some of those guys were really tough. I don't know how the hell I got them out, but I did, I guess.
And that particular ballpark, I mean, fans were right up on you. It was built to be very intimate, so they were close.
Yeah, they were. The fans were pretty close to you, that ballpark. They treated me nice.
Your rookie season, your home ballpark was Scheib Park in Philadelphia.
And it is sunny Scheib Park here this afternoon, everybody, with the wind blowing directly in from behind left center field, blowing diagonally across the diamond and going out from behind first base.
Beautiful on the outside. The outside facade was just gorgeous.
You know, I was never in the big league ballpark until I came to Greek Stadium in Shy Park.
Wow. So you walk into, for instance, someplace like Shy Park, where there's this giant right field wall, the so-called spite wall or spite fence built in right field, because fans on the other side of the right field wall that lived in these row houses would invite their friends and family over to watch games from their rooftops. And naturally, the team's management were not thrilled about that. So they built this wall that went higher than the roofs so that people couldn't look in. Was that spite wall there when you were pitching? The giant right field wall that...
Yeah, they had that.
That probably made you feel pretty good as a pitcher. Like, okay, I can kind of get away with one a little inside here.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't know how I was thinking. I was just trying to get them out. I didn't really think worrying too much about the walls, except in Yankee Stadium that was always so close. And yet I really liked pitch against the Yankees for some reason, because I think I beat them four times one year. And I always liked to pitch there because of, if I didn't let them pull the ball down the left field, right field line, I could make them hit the ball other than pulling the ball. I had a good chance of beating them. And that one year, I think it was 52 when I won 24. I think I beat them four times, I believe. And they had a good ball club, too, in Mantle.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yogi and Hank Bauer and Moose Gowan, they were tough.
And the first time you faced Mickey Mantle?
He was tough. I had a hell of a time getting him out. I had a rough time with him, but I really liked to pitch against him that much. But then I ended up getting traded to the Yankees, and I had to pitch against him anymore.
Yeah, that probably made you feel a lot better, huh?
Yeah, he was a good ball player. I'll tell you, a nice guy, too.
Bobby, June 5th, 1949, you beat Bob Feller and the Cleveland Indians at Cleveland Stadium. It was the first game of a doubleheader. And after the game, you took a shower and went out for a walk along the lakefront. When you returned, you tried to walk into the clubhouse and there was an attendant there who wouldn't let you in. Do you remember that?
There was a couple times that they wouldn't let me in the ballpark because I was too small.
Bobby Shands is not the biggest man in the world. And undoubtedly, that's a fact known to a great many of you also.
The guy said this door is for ball players only. He thought you were a kid playing hooky.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that. A couple of times they wouldn't let me in the ballpark, but that was in Cleveland, I think, wasn't it?
It was in Cleveland, and your buddy, teammate Sam Chapman, happened to show up and about the same time as you, and he said, no, he's on our team. Bobby's with us.
Yeah, I could remember who it was that came by, but somebody had to take me in. I don't know if that was the same night I pitched. I wasn't sure.
Your wife, Shirley, would get too nervous sometimes to attend home games at Chive Park, but she would listen on the radio, right?
Yeah. She used to be scared I was going to get knocked out. A lot of times she didn't want to listen, I don't think.
Which brings me, Bobby, to one day when I know she wishes she would have either been listening or could have been in person. August 12th, 1950 at Yankee Stadium.
Now up comes Bobby Shands. A very colorful little performer.
You hit the one and only home run in your career just beyond the rail in left field.
Yes, I can remember that. I did forget that, I'll tell you that.
Allie Reynolds was pitching. Was that one of the greatest feelings of your life?
Yeah, man, that was really good. And then years later, we were going to an old-timers game in Yankee Stadium, and I'm sitting there putting my uniform on, and somebody taps me on my shoulder, and I look up, and it was Allie Reynolds.
Oh, it was Allie Reynolds?
Yeah, it was Allie Reynolds. We were both at the same game. He came over to me, and he tapped me on my shoulder. I didn't know who the hell it was. I looked up, and he said, do you remember me? And I said, no, who are you? He said, I want to know how you get a home run off of me. I said, I'm a pretty good hitter. He said, yeah, you were a pretty good hitter, he says.
In between your 1950 and 1951 season, you and Shirley, your wife, went back to her hometown in Lincoln, Nebraska, and you got a job delivering mail for the post office.
Oh, yeah. I used to deliver mail. Later, I got a job. Every year, I used to go back here after the season. I'd get a job in a liquor store.
Lincoln, Nebraska, in, I don't know, November and December, I would imagine pretty cold to be delivering mail.
Yeah, it was cold. It was really cold. Yeah, very cold out there. Nice town, though. Very nice town.
There was a curfew in Pennsylvania that would not allow games at Scheib Park to go past 6:59 p.m. on Sundays. And I know at least there was one game in particular where the Philadelphia A's were beating the Yankees in the seventh inning, and the game was called because of the curfew. The Yankees lost because the score would revert back to the last full inning of play when the A's, I think, were up 7-4. And Yankees manager...
I lucked out, huh?
Yeah, Yankees manager Casey Stengel was not happy about that curfew.
I'm glad it happened.
In addition to your mom and dad, your grandpop loved baseball too, didn't he?
Yeah, he liked baseball, huh? Yeah. In the basement, he used to make beer. Yeah, he used to make beer somehow. I don't know how the hell he was doing it. My dad never drank, but his dad, we used to make beer. But I don't know, maybe it was liquor too. I don't know what the hell he was making, something down there.
In 1951, Bobby, you made your first All-Star game. That year it was played at Briggs Stadium in Detroit.
Briggs Stadium, Detroit, for the 18th All-Star game between Eddie Sawyer's National Leaguers and Casey Stengel's American League favorites in the midseason classic. Ty Cobb tosses out the first ball, and 1951's Midsummer Thriller unfolds for 52,000 fans.
You're walking into a clubhouse with all these guys that you probably admired growing up.
Yeah, I know. You're right. I said, what the hell am I doing here? And that one All-Star game, I pitched one inning.
You're talking about the one where you struck out Whitey Lockman, Jackie Robinson, and Stan Musial. No, that was in Philadelphia at Scheib Park.
That was in Philadelphia, that's right.
In 52.
Whitey Lockman, Jackie Robinson, and Stan Musial.
The 26-year-old, 5'7", 145-pound Mighty Atom had given the fans their biggest thrill by striking out the side on only 13 pitches.
And then it started raining, thank God, and then they couldn't knock me out.
The rains came to halt the classic after five innings, and a wet but happy throng of fans trooped home.
Well, listen, had it not rained, you might try to go for what Carl Hubbell did, you know, where he...
Well, that's what they said in the paper the next day, yeah, but I don't know, it was raining pretty hard, so I didn't think I might have got knocked out in the next inning, too. Who the hell knows? You don't know.
Well, I can't imagine thinking as I'm going back to the hotel that night, hey, I just struck out Whitey Lockman, Jackie Robinson, and Stan Musial in order.
I was doing pretty good, I'll say that.
Yeah, I bet. Bobby, what was it like playing for Connie Mack?
Well, Connie didn't do much managing. You know, he was a very quiet man, never said too much. And I think the second year I was with the A's, he had his son Earl managed most of the time. And Connie never said too much. Every once in a while, he'd wave the scorecard and tell the outfield that trying to get the outfielders to move a little bit, you know.
Yeah.
But he didn't really do too much of the managing because he was very quiet and really, really a nice man.
Your best pitch, Bobby, your out pitch, was probably your knuckleball. Did you see someone throw it, or how did it come to be that you started throwing that?
I saw Hoyt Wilhelm throwing that thing, and he was really good with it, but I started messing around with it a while, and it took me about 3 or 4 years before I started throwing it. And then I couldn't get it over the plate. After I started getting over the plate, that was a very good pitch for me, because if I got two strikes on somebody, and I could throw that sucker, if I could get it around the plate, I could get somebody out. I got quite a few guys out with that knuckleball.
I imagine some of the faces of bewilderment after they're watching that ball come dance its way across the plate.
It used to jump around pretty good. I ended up with a pretty good knuckleball, but it was, the trouble was they'd be getting it over the plate. You know, I mean, that was the trouble. After I threw it enough, it took me a couple of years really to start throwing that thing. But after I got it where I could throw it near the plate, I got a lot of guys out with it.
Chance to the windup round comes the left arm. The payoff pitch is in there for call strike three.
You can't tell me that you didn't have a good chuckle every now and then after guys would strike out with that pitch.
Yeah, I sure got quite a few guys. A lot of guys couldn't hit that sucker, though. A lot of guys were swinging at it when they had two strikes on it, and some was in the dirt sometime, and they swung at it.
August 31st, 1952, you appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show in full uniform.
Yeah, I do. I have a picture of him in my room.
Right now in the Philadelphia Athletics, which was Grove's team, there's a little fellow, much smaller than Grove, who this year has won 22 games. And the thing that has attracted tremendous attention, not only his winning streak, but the fact that he's about 5'5". He steps in there and beats the big fellows. Ladies and gentlemen, we presented a lot of champions on this stage, but here is one of the greatest, Bobby Shantz.
You were showing Ed how to throw a fastball and a curveball.
Would you show some of the way you grip a ball? in delivering it and explain what the grip is for and what pitch you're throwing?
Now, this is the way I hold a fastball across the seams. And this is a curveball. I hold that right on the seams.
Right on the seams.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have a picture of that?
I actually have the video of that.
Do you?
Yeah.
Yeah, one of my kids has that video, and I was listening to that, yeah.
I know that you don't like public speaking, so I imagine that was not one of your favorite nights. I mean, you probably liked Ed Sullivan, but
No, I'm surprised I went on the Ed Sullivan show, take you to, but that was right after I had that real good year, I guess.
It was late in the summer in 52, yeah, so it was during that year.
Yeah, I was scared to death. Yeah, that was TV, man. I got a picture right in my room here. I'm looking at it right now.
November 13th, 1952, Bill Ingram from the Associated Press called your dad and mom's home to tell you that you had been selected AL MVP. Some of the previous winners were Yogi Berra, Ted Williams, Joe DiMaggio, and here Bill is calling you to tell you that you're the MVP. Well, tell me about that moment. You must have been so excited.
Well, yeah, I was really excited. Yeah, I couldn't believe it that they picked me as the MVP because there was a lot of guys had real good years that year.
Mickey Mantle, Yogi Berra.
Yeah, I know. Good ball players too. I was very surprised when they picked me as the MVP, but I was very happy. And even until today, I'm very happy because I'm getting invited to card shows. I make a few bucks out of that. That's really nice. And I still get a lot of mail. When I write my name on the ball, they want me to put 1952 AL MVP, and that makes me feel like $1 million.
Joe Astroth, the man who catches while Bobby tosses, gave us a few tips on why Bobby is so outstanding. He can get any pitch he throws over the plate, and he throws them all. A knuckler, a sneaky fastball, a curve, a screwball, all of them. Bobby has one of the best curves in the majors, and he can throw it from three positions, overhand, three quarters, and sidearm.
You finished that season 24-7, including five shutouts that year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a good year. I couldn't do anything wrong. Pretty lucky.
Do you still have that award, that plaque somewhere?
Oh, yeah. I got that right above my fireplace down in my den.
How old is your wife?
My wife?
Yeah.
She's 96.
Okay, now when she asks you to take out the trash, do you walk by that MVP and go?
I'm getting so damn old. I'm sitting on my rear end watching TV, and I'm looking at that MVP every minute. Of course, I got 8 gold gloves, and I got them around my den, and I kind of look at them once in a while.
Do you have all 8 still?
Yeah, I still have them.
Wow.
He's one of the best fielding pitchers in the league. He's so quick that it's almost impossible to get a line drive through the middle of the diamond.
In 1955, the Athletics moved to Kansas City.
Kansas City proves its baseball pride by queuing up for tickets whenever the A's are in town. Spacious Municipal Stadium. One of the most modern in the game, this giant arena was built in record time when the A's came to town.
Did you like pitching there?
Well, I was having trouble with my shoulder a little bit. Lou Boudreau was the manager. My arm was feeling pretty good. Started feeling pretty good. He asked me if I was all right to pitch. And I pitched against the Yankees, and we shut him out, believe it or not, 6-0.
Yeah.
Not too much longer after that, I was traded to the Yankees.
1957, that was your first year with the Yankees, right? 57?
Yeah, 57. 57, 58, 59, and 60, I was with New York.
And you're playing for Hall of Fame manager Casey Stengel. What did you do? Do you have because he was a character. Do you have a favorite Casey story?
I used to get letters in the mail. They say, you pitch for Connie Mack and you pitch for Casey Stengel. He said, what was the difference? I'd always write that back to him, saying, Connie Mack never said a damn word, and Casey never shut up.
Is it true, Bobby, that there were times where Casey would fall asleep by the second inning and you'd have to wake him up?
Yeah, he used to sleep every once in a while, but because he had pretty good coaches. You had Ralph Alf coaching and Jim Turner and Frank Rossetti. He had pretty good coaches, so he didn't have to worry too much about anybody. One time I was pitching against the Red Sox, and we won that game the day before. So now I think we're still playing the Red Sox a game afterwards. And we were ahead in the game in the ninth inning, and I had pitched the previous game the day before. And I didn't even take my glove out when I was sitting in the dugout. I just watched the game, and Yogi come over to me, and he said, Mantle has to go on the Ed Sullivan show. And Casey hollered down to me, he said, Shantz, go out and finish the game in center field. He put me out in center field. I had to go into the clubhouse and get my glove. I didn't even have my damn glove. So anyway, I got my glove, went out to center field, and I'm sure I can play center field because I'm a pretty good fielder. But I said, geez, I hope nobody hits a damn ball out here because I hope I can catch it. And you know, the first hitter hit the ball right to me.
Did you catch it?
I couldn't believe that. Yeah, I caught the damn thing, but it scared the hell out of me. We ended up winning the game 6-3.
What did you think of Yankee Stadium? You think about Lou Gehrig played there and Babe Ruth and...
I always liked to pitch in Yankee Stadium for some reason. I don't know, not because I thought I could beat the Yankees, but I did beat the Yankees, I guess, 11 or 12 times. I'm not sure, but four times that one year. But I always liked to pitch in New York because of down the line, it was about 3-9 and 3-10. If you keep these guys, these good hitters, if you can keep them from pulling the boy, you could beat the Yankees.
But center field was a mile. So, yeah, if you could keep the ball.
Yeah, that's why I say if you could keep them hitting the ball to the left. Left center field, right center field, you could beat them son of a gun. So probably the reason I beat them like I did.
Every year for the past, I don't know how many years, you've gone back to your high school in Pottstown, Pennsylvania and thrown out the first pitch for Bobby Shantz Day.
I said to the guy, I can't get my left arm up because I threw so many pitches with my left arm for 16 years, you know. They call me to throw out the first pitch. I can't even get my arm up. And they say, well, just roll it in. Don't worry about it. But I get up there and I throw the pitch with my right hand. They don't even know the difference.
And you, a lot of times, have worn a very special New York Yankees cap for that throwout, right?
Yeah, I still wear that damn thing. I have, Casey Stengel gave me that cap, and he said, always wear that thing, and I'm still wearing it, and it's dirty as hell. I got to get my wife to wash it, but I still wear it.
That's so great. Hey, Bobby, you played in the 1960 World Series, one of the most dramatic in baseball history. In Game 7, Jim Coates came in to relieve you.
The last half of the eighth inning, Bobby Shantz, victimized by the bad hop, will now depart.
There was a play after you came out where Roberto Clemente hits a ball to first base and Jim Coates is supposed to cover, but he doesn't.
Hearts race and pulses pound here in this last half of the eighth inning, the final game of the World Series. Burden moves off third, Grote off second. One ball, two shots, 7-5 New York. Runners widen their leads. And Clemente hits a soft dribbler towards Scourin, and nobody's going to get over. Bases loaded. Check that. One run came in on the play. Burden came on from third. Grote went to third. It is 7-6.
Yeah, he didn't get over there in time. I think that might have been the third out.
That would have been a play that you would have made in your sleep, 8-time Gold Glove winner.
Yeah, Clemente topped that ball down the first baseline, and Moose got it, but Coach didn't get over there in time. But they ended up beating us that damn series.
Well, because after he doesn't get over there to cover, he gives up that home run to Hal Smith, which changes everything.
Yeah, right. The thing that killed us was in the eighth inning when Burden hit a ground ball, took a bad hop and hit him in the throat.
There's the ground ball, hit to short, knocked, and it hits Kubek in the face, and all hands are safe. Bobby Shantz got him to come up with what appeared to be the double play ball. It took the hop and hit Kubek in the face.
Double play ball, we'd have been out of the inning, and sure, I could have finished the game because that was the eighth inning, and I was getting them out pretty good.
Yeah, you were. Yeah, I mean, up through five innings in relief, you had only given up one hit at one point. But Mazeroski wins the game, with a walk-off.
There's the drive into deep left field. Look out now. That ball is going out. There it goes. Mazeroski hits it over the left field fence for a home run, and the Pirates win it 10-9 and win the World Series.
Where were you at when that happened?
I was probably in the clubhouse because they took me out.
Do you remember what the clubhouse was like after that?
It was very quiet, I'll tell you that. Yeah, I was ashamed to lose that thing. I'm sure if that ball don't hit Kubek in the throat, I'm sure I could have pitched the ninth inning and won that game.
What was your favorite ballpark to play in? Did you have one where you thought, man, I feel comfortable here every time I play, every time I pitch?
I always did like to pitch at Yankee Stadium. I don't know why, but they beat me just as much as I beat them, I guess. But I knew I beat them quite a few times. But I always liked to pitch in Yankee Stadium for some reason. I didn't like to pitch in Fenway Park because that wall was too close.
The Green Monster, yeah.
Yeah, I never did like to pitch there, but I didn't have too much bad luck there. I was always a little shaky there because of that wall. It always looked so close. You stand on a mound and it looked like a shortstop.
You were friends long, long time with Kurt Simmons, right?
Oh, yeah. Kurt and Robin Roberts had a golf course 2 miles from my house, and I used to play golf over there all the time. They used to let me play for nothing.
Who was better? Who was the better golfer?
We were all pretty much the same. I never played golf until they got that golf course moving, and I used to go over there almost every day. I got down to a five handicap, and that was really good. Robin Roberts was a good golfer, and so was Kurt. They were all pretty good golfers, too.
You owned your own bowling alley. You could have done, you were a great bowler.
I wasn't that good. I averaged about 165, but I wasn't that good of a bowler. I really liked the bowl. We had that bowling alley for over 20 years.
And the restaurant, the little restaurant on the side,
yeah,
right?
And then we only had 12 alleys, so we decided to build a dairy bar beside of the bowling alley. I ran that for 23 years.
What was the best thing you guys served there?
Cheesesteaks. Yeah.
Yeah.
We had really good cheesesteak. A lot of people used to love those things.
Well, now you've made me hungry.
Yeah, I wish I could have one right now.
Well, hey, listen, Bobby, I really appreciate the time. It's been so much fun.
Thank you.
Looking back on an amazing career and life, and just to think about all the different people. Do you have a favorite moment of your career?
Yeah, when I was picked the most valuable player in 1952, and I won 24 games, I had 27 complete games.
How many years have you been married now?
75.
What is the key to longevity?
I have no idea. Just being lucky, I guess. Because I still feel pretty good. I don't look that great anymore. I never did really look that good. But I still feel pretty damn good for being 98, I'll tell you that.
Is there something you do every day that you go, wow, this makes
me... Yeah, I'm sitting on my ass all the time. I'm watching television. I have my favorite seat there. I go down there in the morning and then I take a little ride through Ambler, and then I come home, and then I sit till about 10 o'clock, and I go to bed.
I'm sure you know this, but people love you. The number of people who listen to Lost Ballparks who have asked me to try to get you to come on and talk.
I know that because of the mail I get. I get, honest to God, I can't believe I still get all the mail I get. The people write me such nice letters, and they tell me how much they think I've done for baseball, and all that, and that really makes me feel good.
When was the last game you played? How many years ago was that? I mean, last year was 60...
64.
64, so...
Yeah, 64 was my name, with the Phillies.
I'm terrible at math, but I think that's 60 years. So it's been 60 years since you played, and you're still getting this mail, and I think that's great.
Yeah, I love to get mail, man. I like to sit down and answer those people. I don't let them sit here on my desk more than a couple hours. I sign everything. Bats to sign and gloves to sign and all kind of mail. I love that.
Well, I'm sure there'll be a few more to sign after this. I tell you, Bobby Shantz, I've enjoyed every single minute of this time that we've had together. How's your
Thank
wife?
You.
How's your wife doing?
She went to the hairdresser today. She was feeling pretty good. So we're hanging in there. She's 96. She's trying to catch me.
She's almost there.
Yeah. Yeah, I hope she catches me. Well, it's nice of you to call. I appreciate you talking to me.
All right. Hey, Bobby, take care and tell your wife I said hello.
I will. Thank you. Thanks for calling.
What a life. What an incredible life. Overcoming a childhood disease that nearly took his life, living through the Great Depression, serving in World War II, and then against all odds, pitching 16 years in the big leagues, finishing with 119 wins, a three-time All-Star, eight-time Gold Glover, winning the 1952 AL MVP in the 1958 World Series, and most importantly of all, being married to his sweet wife, Shirley, for 75 years. There are so many people who were incredibly helpful in securing this interview with Bobby Shantz, but two in particular were Tom Coyle and Dick Hines. Without those two guys, this would not have happened. So thank you both, gentlemen. The Lost Ballparks podcast is produced by Mike Dunn, Manny Zavlakis, Xavier Guerra, John McBride, Kyle Schmidt, Mike Lipinski, Ryan Beard, John Carter, Alex Kemp, and Curtis Litzenberger. Join me again on the first Wednesday of next month for another episode of the Lost Ballparks podcast.